I wanted to talk some this evening on the topic of beauty. And it came up for me this Saturday when we were doing a one-day sitting here. And I did a lot of interviews through the day. And I had the very strong sense during the day, and that I often do when I see people, especially in interviews on retreats, in that kind of context, that I wish I had a mirror, a kind of special kind of mirror, that I could just hold up and show them who they are. Because I often get the sense that there's a lot more beauty there. I mean, I see beauty in everybody who comes. And I can't. It seems to me like they don't see it themselves well enough. And if only they could see what I see, that they would, it'd be great. They'd be pretty happy. The mindfulness itself is often... Is this working okay? Everybody's happy? Okay. Little what? Little bit louder? You want it? You want it louder?
Yeah.
You are. Okay. Because I'm very self-conscious. But that's, I guess, the way it goes. Mindfulness itself can sometimes likened to a mirror. And a mirror is something that reflects things as they are, it said, and does so impartially, without bias, without blinders, without preference of what's there. Something really ugly comes in front of the mirror, and the mirror just reflects it without any comment. Something beautiful comes across the mirror, and the mirror reflects it as it is. And if something is both beautiful and ugly, it reflects both parts of it. And so mindfulness has this quality of just a kind of presence with how things are and seeing things as they actually are without comment, without being for or against it. And part of the beauty of... I changed. It's just the machine is... So if you have trouble hearing at some point, let me know. But it seems like, you know, that electricity has its own... has its own life here today. So mindfulness is a mirror. And some people find it very liberating, that quality of mindfulness, that there's a part of their psyche that can simply, independently be aware. Some people call it being the observer of whatever's going on, as opposed to being caught by it or reactive to it. Or there's other parts of the psyche which, you know, has a much more complicated relationship with how things are. But it simply see things as they are without comment is a beautiful part and lends itself to a kind of freedom. And however, I think for many times the mirror that we use or how we use our mirror might have filters on it or curtains over parts of it, so that, you know, we pull the curtain a little bit and we see certain part of who we are, and we don't pull the other curtain to see the rest of it. And sometimes there's choices about which curtains we pull. And sometimes we pull only the curtains that show us how terrible we are, the negative side, you know. And so some people specialize in pulling those curtains. And so the curtains that show the beautiful side of us, they haven't gotten used so much, the pulleys are rusty, so they're hard to get them to work. And other people specialize in showing the beautiful parts. And they often then will deny or push away or not notice the parts that are maybe not so desirable. They need some work, perhaps, or they need some more attention, perhaps. And but, you know, mind function of mindfulness is to pull the curtains apart completely and see things as they actually are. And it's said, or I'll say, that mindfulness that sees that way is healing, is liberating. Produces health. Moves us in the direction of health. And so a lot of what we're doing in mindfulness practice is not only learning how to see, but learning how to see in the totality of who we are, not in any particular one way that we think we have to be, or think we should be, or think we are in some limited way. So I often get the sense that when people come to see me, that people are seeing themselves in somewhat limited ways. And often not always, but often it's that side that where they're having difficulties, difficulties with the practice or difficulty with themselves. And that's what they present, that's what the words are about. But I often see this tremendous sincerity and beauty, many, many qualities, coming through as people talk about them, about what's going on. And it, I feel like very fortunate in my role as a meditation teacher, because to the great majority of times, people, I see the best of people, even though they come and tell me the worst. And but you know, they're coming, you know, expressing the truth, and they're talking about how they're working with something with great sincerity, and it's really lovely, that part. So I wish I had this mirror. So what is you know, what is beauty, and where is beauty found? And I would like to suggest that, or maybe say it more personally, for me, the greatest beauty that's found is found in the human heart, in the human psyche, the mind. Probably one of the most beautiful things to be found is a heart which is liberated, which is free. The kind of purity and clarity that can be there for that. But there are other qualities of heart that are also very beautiful. A heart that's filled with love, or some love, compassion, equanimity, generosity. A heart which is has integrity to it, that is expressing and living integrity, is quite a beautiful thing to see and to be part of. And to see it in oneself also, to feel the taste, the texture of integrity, is quite a wonderful thing. I remember how surprised I was when the first time I really tasted it, the taste of integrity. I've been sitting for some time on retreat, and then I remembered some unwholesome, unskillful, unhealthy thoughts that I had some weeks earlier. And I tried to kind of evoke them, those kinds of thoughts, that kind of approach. And it just didn't wash. It just kind of felt so foreign to the state that I was in. And I was became so palpable, the sense kind of purity or integrity that had come from me from all that sitting. Not from trying, but just had come. So the beauty that is unrecognized, that we often don't recognize. In the Buddhist tradition, the word we often translate as mind can equally be translated as heart. And so it's a little bit hard sometimes to translate into English to know, should we say mind, should we say heart? And so as I say heart today, I'll just use the word heart. You can translate it as mind if you prefer that. But mind has more of a cognitive kind of sense, whereas heart has a little more of an emotional sense, perhaps. That which we put our heart into is that which we kind of have trust and faith or commitment to and involve ourselves in a heartfelt way. And so the heart, the citta is the Pali word, is often translated as the heart, or sometimes heart-mind. And the heart is kind of the citta is the overall, the citta is an activity. It's not a thing. So part of the problem with using the word heart is it's just a noun, something which is as it is. But the heart in Buddhism, the citta, is an activity. And that activity has different, can take different shapes or it can function in different ways. And so the heart has the overall mood or overall texture or overall state that it is in different times. And that overall mood or state of the heart is dependent on many of the ecology of things within that heart. The heart is not a unitary thing either. It's an activity. It's not a unitary thing. It's made up of many different factors that are operating together and affecting each other. And so the whole ecology affects the overall mood or state of that heart, of that mind or that consciousness. And so in the great way in which Buddhists like to look very closely at things and kind of divide up and see clearly what's going on, differentiate between all the little aspects of what's going on in our hearts. They'll differentiate between four different general categories or classes of hearts that we can have. And the first two are pairs. And the word is kusala and akusala. And they refer to hearts which are either involved in skillful qualities, skillful activities, or unskillful. That's literal translation, skillful and unskillful. But hearts which are involved in healthy activities, or hearts which are involved in unhealthy activities, minds which are involved in wholesome qualities, having wholesome qualities in it, or a mind which has unwholesome qualities in it. So if you have a lot of propensities towards hate and anger, and the mind is gripped by its anger and its hate, and those quality of anger and angry thoughts, angry feelings, angry motivations are kind of there, then the shape or the quality of the state of that mind is going to be called an unskillful state of mind, or an unhealthy. It's a state of mind which is not conducive towards health. It's rather conducive to unhealth or disease. If a mind is filled with or involved and engaged in feelings of generosity, of goodwill, then it's said that the state of that mind is one which is skillful, one that is healthy and healthy producing. It's a healthy state of mind conducive to creating more health. So a state of mind which is kusala or akusala is not only is what it is, but also tends in a certain direction, tends either towards further health or further disease. So those are the first two general categories of hearts that we can experience, the way the hearts can be at different times. The next kind of state of mind or state of heart that we can experience is called vipaka. And vipaka refers to, means resultant, that which results because of things before it. So if I turn that switch over there off, the lights go off. The lights go off, that's the resultant of switching, doing that switch. So certain states of mind, certain states of heart, are the result. Result is a product of things that have happened in the past, activities, way we've been in the past. So if I sit here and meditate, in meditation, for example, and I suddenly feel really sad, that sadness might have nothing to do with the activity that I'm engaged in right now, but rather something might have happened earlier in the day. Maybe I'm sad about what I said to someone. And so my sadness is a carryover, a continuation, or a product of some activity that happened earlier in the day. So there's a lot of moods, mental states, thoughts that can arise for us, which are, in a sense, Buddhists like to say, are almost impersonal, in that they're there because they're the resultant of things that happened, momentum that was set in motion in the past. And sometimes it can be years or decades before something is set in motion, and something pops up. So, for example, physically, if I sit and have, if I sit down, or before I sit, I'm going about my day and having a great, jolly time, as far as I can tell, and because I'm so busy and involved and doing all the things, and then I sit down to meditate, and finally my life catches up to me, and I sit down and I notice, and I notice that my shoulders are tense, or I notice that my mind is a little bit wound up. If I'm not involved anymore in tense activities, then that tension in the mind or in the shoulders is called a resultant. It's just there, it has to be there, because if you do X, it causes Y. And so it's kind of a cause and effect relationship. So certain mind states or heart states are called resultant. And we take it as impersonal in Buddhism because it just the job then in mindfulness is just to simply see it as it is and not to engage in it with it anymore. If you feel sad or angry or happy, as a resultant of something in the past, you just let it bubble up there and see it clearly. And in seeing it clearly, that's where the liberation or the health can come. So was that clear enough? Okay. The fourth class or category of cittas, of hearts, is what is called kiriya. I think it's pronounced. And this is states of mind which are not the results of past karma, past activities, and it's also neither skillful or unskillful. It's neither conducive towards greater health or conducive to less psychic or spiritual health. And this is a state of mind which is that of someone who's liberated. Someone who's liberated, someone who's fully awakened in Buddhism, is said not to need any more skillful states, mind states, doesn't need good qualities in their minds to be conducive towards greater health because they've attained the spiritual health. And so when they do things, it has no karmic effect in the fact that it doesn't participate anymore in this moving towards health or moving towards disease. Now, some people will say that this kriya consciousness is something that only arises for people when they're fully liberated. Some great Big Bang theory of enlightenment and boom, you know, you got it. And other people will say that that this is something that everybody falls into, or it occurs to everyone at some points through the day. That there are times in the day when we have unskillful states, times in the day we have skillful states, times of the day we have this resultant kind of states that simply arise, and times in the day when some kind of when the liberating qualities of the mind, the liberated mind, the purity of mind, simply is there. And we respond, we speak, we are, I mean, some people say spontaneously or naturally in a certain way, that it just kind of expresses that purity, that natural state of the mind when it's resting in itself and is liberated. So different opinions about whether that an ordinary person can have occasional liberated mind, or whether it's something that only happens after some Big Bang theory of enlightenment or some big lot of practice or something. So I shouldn't ask, are you following me? Maybe I should ask rather, someone not following me well enough, are you willing to go along? Mm-hmm. Are you okay? So a lot of Buddhist practice traditionally is focusing on this pair between the skillful and the unskillful states of mind, recognizing them and seeing them. And I'll talk in a little while more later about why it's important to recognize it. But to make this very simple discernment, the state of mind or activity of mind that I'm involved in now is unskillful. It's unhealthy. Or another one is healthy. What you're asked not to do, and be very careful about not doing, is when you notice that you have an unhealthy state of mind, you don't want to attack it or feel self-judgment or self-criticism or self-loathing because of that. Because then you're doing another unhealthy activity on top of an unhealthy activity. And so then you're digging your own grave. And so you try to keep it really simple. That's why the mirror is a really wonderful analogy for mindfulness. We just see it as it is. No comment, just see it clearly. And so then there's lists. Okay, so that's what, those are general categories, classes of minds or hearts that you can have. Those four kinds. But those four kinds are made up of an ecology of many different factors that work together. And so rather than being a very simplistic division between skillful and unskillful, you have to actually look at the subtleties of it all, of all the different mental factors that come into play and play with each other, work with each other, to create whether it's skillful or unskillful. And so this is where the ancient Buddhists were kind of brilliant in looking at how the mind works and kind of trying to understand how all the different mind factors kind of bounce off each other and influence each other. And they came up with 52, in our particular tradition, the Theravada tradition, 52 kind of mental factors that go into shaping the quality of the mind at any given time. And of these 52 factors, something like 11 of them, or 7 of them, are always there, regardless the kind of mind you have, whether it's skillful or unskillful, whatever you have, the mind always has these 7 qualities or factors active. One is something called contact. Like if you see something, you're seeing, making contact with what you see. So that's considered kind of a mental factor. And then there's perception. You perceive what that is. And then there is kind of what's called the feeling tone, the vedana. And then there's the intention in relationship to that. So it's very interesting. Buddhists will say that every mind moment has some intentionality as part of it. And then there's something called life force, life energy, vitality that's part of that. It's considered kind of a quality of heart. And then there's the averting of the mind, of bringing the mind to focus on something. Also, there's one-pointedness of mind, the ability of the mind to not just avert and pay attention to something, but then have one-pointed attention on it. So those are considered to be always there. And then there's some factors of mind which are sometimes there and sometimes not. And these I won't go through them, that's not important, you get lost in all these lists. Then the next one is more interesting, because this is those mental factors which are themselves considered unhealthy. And then there can be some discussion or some controversy or debate about are these really unhealthy or how are they unhealthy or something like that. But they're called unskillful. They're not conducive towards spiritual health, towards freedom from reduction of suffering. And so I'll give you this list of what they are. And there might be one or two of them that's relevant for you occasionally. Ignorance, shamelessness, or lack of conscience, recklessness, restlessness, attachment, wrong view, conceit, aversion, envy, stinginess, regret, sloth, torpor, and doubt. So those come into play. And they can appear, a number of them together in different ways, or they can have a full-blown attack of all of them at once, or something perhaps. And when these are operating and playing, then they come up in many different ways. Sometimes they're intentional. We pick them up and act on them. Sometimes they seem to be no intention of our own, but they seem to be there. And they kind of, sometimes the mind feels very contracted and tight, or the heart feels squeezed. Or if you really feel these very powerfully and very sensitive to them, it feels very uncomfortable to feel some of these states, and you know, people will come and talk about how painful some of these things can be. And when the heart is gripped by these factors, then the unfortunate thing is that they then tend to be conducive towards greater states of disease. So it's not a judgment. All this is not involved in the judgment of good and bad. It's not a moral judgment on these, that you're a good or bad person if you have these. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing that this is where this, if you have to understand what the illness is if you want to get healthy. And here they're pointing to these are the factors of illness that lead towards further suffering, to lead towards greater stress or being burdened or suffering in some way. And so part of the mirror is to see these things very clearly. Now we come, so that was the akusala, that's the unskillful factors of mind. And those are the ones, when they come up and appear, that shape the heart into an unhealthy heart, unhealthy state of heart. So, skillful heart, unskillful heart. Skillful factors, and you think then that would be the opposite would be the unskillful factors, and the opposite would be the skillful factors. But they don't use the word skillful as the opposite to unskillful factors. They use the word in Pali, sobhana. And sobhana is often translated as the word beautiful. And sometimes it also has the meaning of to shine, to be resplendent, to be kind of luminous. So these are the beautiful factors of mind. So there's the unhealthy or unskillful factors of mind, and there's the beautiful ones. Isn't that great? So this is where we come to the heart of the talk, because I was inspired to talk about beauty, right? So here are the beautiful factors of the mind. So when you see one of the ways to see beauty in someone, or perhaps you can listen to this list and see when you notice someone and you see them being really beautiful in some deep kind of in their hearts, the hearts are beautiful, their psyche, their soul is beautiful. Are you seeing these factors in some way? Are they operating in some way, or different combinations of them perhaps? So this is the list of beautiful mental factors or trust, mindfulness, self-respect, a healthy kind of remorse, non-attachment, non-aversion, equanimity, tranquility, lightness, pliancy, wieldiness, proficiency, uprightness. That's part of the list. And so trust, I think, is a beautiful quality. Sometimes it's translated as faith or confidence. But if you have this, to repeat what I said, this idea of being heartfelt about something. If you're really heartfelt about the work you do, or heartfelt about the relationship you're in or the activity you're involved in, there's a kind of beautiful quality that comes along, and if you're heartfelt about it, it kind of implies a certain kind of purity or beauty, I think, that you'd be heartfelt. To have your to trust something, to have your trust in something in a heartfelt way, is considered to be part of a beautiful aspect of the heart. Mindfulness itself is considered to be a beautiful aspect of the mind or the heart. And so, so what the tradition will say is that if you are mindful of unhealthy states of mind, you're meeting the unhealthy states of mind with something beautiful, with something healthy. And many of us become self-conscious very easily. And we confuse self-consciousness with being mindful. And so then, you know, self-consciousness kind of, you know, leads to, more often than not, kind of to lack of health. We kind of bury ourselves in all the associations of being self-conscious. But when there's pure mindfulness, we're meeting something with health, with beauty. And then there's a self-respect, which sounds like a nice thing. What it refers to is that is part of the beautiful aspect of the heart is that if you feel or sense the beauty of the heart or the beauty of your own integrity, there's a factor of the heart that says, I don't want to violate that. I don't want to transgress that. I don't want to soil that. So, you know, if you're feeling really good and clear and clean in some very beautiful way someday, and your best friend comes along and you just make this, you know, for no reason at all, you make some awful lie to your friend, you probably feel like it kind of tugs against your heart or kind of rips against your heart in a way. It just doesn't feel so good. And if you feel like you're up against saying a lie like that, that part of the heart that says, oh, wait a minute, you know, I have so much self-respect, I have so much respect for this beautiful heart that I don't want to go that far. I want to protect this beauty in some way. That's considered a factor of the mind. And then there's this healthy remorse or regret. It's considered a very healthy, health-producing function of the mind. If you do a transgression, if you do harm someone intentionally, maybe not intentionally, if you harm someone, to feel regret for what you did. If you go out and lie to your best friend, sleep with your best friend's lover or something, and then lie about it and whatever, and then you go walking down the street, you know, whistling Dixie, like this is the best thing ever. You know, you rob the local bank, and you think it's just the best, right? Or you rear-end some car that's parked, and you drive off, and you look and say, well, not any damage to my car, but too bad that car's total, and you drive off, and it's, you know, you're happy, right? That's considered unhealthy in Buddhism. And that's part of the psyche or the mind that recognizes that this was an unhealthy thing you just did. That is a healthy part of the mind. So that's called this healthy remorse. And it kind of doesn't feel good, but it's still beautiful. And then non-attachment and non-aversion. And non-attachment is almost synonymous with generosity. That's what the tradition says. So this impulse towards being generous is a beautiful factor of the mind. And non-aversion is almost synonymous with love. So the heart that expresses itself in kindness and love is a beautiful heart, a beautiful quality. Equanimity is a beautiful quality. And these others, tranquility, lightness, pliancy, wilderness, proficiency, and uprightness. And then there are seven more factors that are beautiful. But these are differentiated from the first list, because the first list, and this is amazing, I don't know if this is true, but it's very interesting that the tradition will say this. The first list of beautiful factors that I gave you, it said, they always arise together. So if you have one of them, you have all the others together with it. And perhaps it's a matter of degree. You know, so if you have generosity there, it might be very strong. You might not notice that the other factors are there operating maybe in the background because they're out, in the shadow of the, or whatever, hidden by the strength of the generosity. But all these other factors are there at the same time. And they come along and are strengthened by any of the other factors. So remember that mindfulness was one of the beautiful factors. So mindfulness itself, when mindfulness arises, it brings along all these other wonderful factors. It strengthens them. So as you cultivate mindfulness, you might not have any intention or any wish to be more beautiful than you are. But as you practice mindfulness, and mindfulness can seem very dull and plain and you know, recognizing what's happening at present moment. What's happening at present moment is not very interesting. And you're just kind of plugging away, just noticing. And it can not seem very, you know, very wonderful. But the accumulation of doing that over time and the momentum of it, it becomes kind of like a magnet of bringing these other beautiful qualities with it over time. And I've seen that in myself, and I've seen that in many practitioners, that some of these other beautiful qualities seem to come along and grow in them as they continue doing the mindfulness practice, even though they're not trying to develop these other qualities. So I don't know if it's true that all these qualities arise together, but I would like to believe it. But so these things arise together. And then there's some factors, beautiful factors, which don't necessarily always there, but they arise sometimes, maybe depending on causes and conditions or something. And so these are considered factors of mind, and it seems a little bit odd, the next list to me, so part of the first three of them, that they're factors, but so it is. The first one is abstinence from wrong speech. That's a factor of mind. Smita. Another one, abstinence from wrong action, is considered to be a certain factor of mind. Maybe there's a little kind of, you know, DNA down there in that part, in the corner of the, you know, this abstinence from wrong action that gets awakened sometimes. And then abstinence from wrong livelihood is considered to be a beautiful mental or heartfelt factor. The next maybe are more obvious, beautiful. Compassion, sympathetic joy, and wisdom or discernment. So depending on the circumstances, these arise or not, So these are the beautiful parts. So beautiful factors of mind. Remember I said earlier that you would think that the akusala, the unskillful factors of mind, would be matched with the, or somehow in relationship to the skillful factors of mind. But instead of skillful factors of mind, they call it beautiful factors of mind. Remember? Well, the reason for that is that someone who expresses an enlightened mind can have these beautiful factors as part of that enlightened mind. But when it happens in an enlightened mind, they're not skillful or they're not healthy producing. They don't have that effect because they don't need to anymore. There's no karmic effect of them. So they don't want to call them skillful, but they're still the same factors. So they just call the whole bunch, they call them beautiful. So if you ever wondered what an enlightened mind is like, an enlightened heart is like, then the tradition says it's characterized by having these factors within it. Kind of the ecology of an enlightened heart is to have these wonderful things operating in there. Isn't that great? Now you know what it's like. And now, every heart that is not liberated has the potentiality of all these things I've listed today. So, if someone who's not, you know, fully enlightened or partially enlightened, in a way that's really done the work of uprooting the unskillful states, has the potential for unskillful factors of being there, unskillful states. And probably some of you today have had an unskillful mental state, one or two or three or something. It's probably happened or almost happened. So you kind of recognize it a little bit. You know, it's a potential, a possibility there. And there's a possibility and potential of the beautiful states being there and arising. So this is part of our potentiality. So when we look at a human being, when we look at someone else, we see them at the surface of who they are. We also can notice their potentiality. This is a potential they have, all these different aspects of themselves. And what do we choose to look at the most when we look at someone else? I know some people who choose to look at the negative, so-called, the unskillful, and they relate to people that way. Maybe because that's what they're expressing the most. But I know other people who'd like to choose to look at the beautiful. And I have one friend, some of you know, James Berez, who loves to do this. It's kind of like his practice. He likes to look at the beautiful aspects in people because he believes if he looks at it, he draws it out of them. So they're more likely to act that way. So he's kind of like a mirror for that part of them. But how do you look at people? It can lend itself to kind of Pollyannishness, to always looking at the positive and look at the good qualities of someone. It can involve a kind of denial of what's, you know, ugly or unhealthy. But if we remember that the function of mindfulness used to be a mirror, but can the mirror be clear enough to see it all? And if we see it all, then how do we relate to the person? If we see the beautiful and the unskillful, or in ourselves? And if we see the difference, or see these factors there, then one of the ways of practicing a Buddhist spiritual life is to not just simply keep it at the level of the mirror, but use your wisdom, use your discernment to try to strengthen or develop or give greater engagement to those which are skillful or beautiful. So the story that was told after 9/11, maybe many of you heard many times now, but the Native American Indian grandfather was talking to his grandson, and he said, "There are two wolves inside of me fighting. One is the wolf of anger, and the other is the wolf of love." And the grandson asks, which one's going to win? And he says, "Whichever one I feed." So in recognizing the unskillful and the beautiful, which one is going to win out for you? Which one's going to define your ecology of your heart or the state of your mind? And which ones do you feed? And there are times when we feed these things and we don't have to feed them when they're unskillful. And maybe we can keep feeding them or choose to feed them when they're skillful and develop those qualities. And so traditional Buddhists will often spend time actually doing things like acts of generosity, trying to live an ethical life, trying to have compassion, developing their loving kindness, developing these things so they can feed and develop and strengthen these beautiful qualities of heart. However, Buddhist spirituality, at its ultimate level, at its ultimate purpose, is not about developing skillful qualities. It's not about developing the beautiful things, you know, and to become more and more skillful. The point of Buddhist spirituality, ultimately, is to become free. And freedom is not the same thing as becoming skillful. However, becoming skillful or cultivating these beautiful states, as best to a high degree, high enough degree, turns out to be one of the best platforms from which to dive in to the liberated state. It's much harder to do it if you're kind of in the state of the heart is unskillful. That's why it's considered unskillful, because it's unskillful for the purposes of reaching liberation. So, I wish there was a mirror for all of us. There is a mirror, and that mirror is mindfulness. But I wish I could just shine you a mirror, because I see so much beauty in people. And it just makes me happy to see it. And there's a quote by Thomas Merton that I like. It goes something like, I have to paraphrase it wildly because I don't have it with me, I don't remember it so well, but he says something like, I see the secret beauty in all people. And the greatest problem I have is I just want to fall down and bow in front of everyone. So, if you can't use a mirror, then bow. So I hope that this was clear enough tonight, and not too complicated, all this stuff. And maybe it gives you a little sense of beauty and appreciation of it. And as I said in the beginning, one of the most beautiful things, or the most beautiful thing I know, is is the beauty that exists in the hearts, in our hearts. It's more beautiful than any piece of art or anything that I've ever seen in nature, as if it's different than nature. it isn't. But it's really the most beautiful thing. And I hope that this practice of ours helps all of us to let that resplendent, shining, luminous heart be something that we can all enjoy for each other's sake. So, thank you.